In this episode, discover how music has changed because of attention span and what digital marketers and video marketers need to know in order to convince and convert at faster rates.
Discover how video can help you achieve your sales and marketing goals. It all starts right here in Todd Hartley's Video Marketing Mastery. Brought to you by Wirebuds.
What is up? What is up? I'm in Columbus, Ohio. I'm actually in the convention center right now in a side room. And I'm at the National Society of Genetic Counselors Conference. I'm out here because we have roughly 12 or 15 of our clients in the genetic space, and they're exhibiting. And while they're all in the building, it sure makes sense to have me here to go and have coffee meetings and talk about their next quarter and what their goals are and how they can start packaging their videos to convert at faster rates. In past episodes, I've told you about a very important research study that was done in music, where a research doctoral student of music theory at The Ohio State University, Hubert Livili-Gavin, did a study where he looked at the top 10 songs for 30 years from 1986 to 2015 and found a dramatic shift in the way songs, the most popular songs of the year, got to the lyrics and the introductions, right, the intros, and how the tempo changed. And he noticed that the intros averaged more than 20 seconds in the mid-80s, and now in 2015, because of the changing attention span, those introductions to the top 10 songs are now 5 seconds long. Now, I want you to listen to this interview. When I came out here to Columbus to meet with clients, I also today got myself on campus at Ohio State, sat down with Hubert, and I want you to listen to the interview. If you want to get show notes to this episode, you can get them at wirebuzz.com/119. This is episode 119. So that's the short code, wirebuzz.com/119. And sit back, listen to this interview, and then think about how you can take Hubert's information and adjust the way you are getting to the point in your videos so you can pull somebody faster through a buyer's journey. And Hubert, what were you originally looking at, and what was your goal behind analyzing music?
So my main point of interest is that, so I'm interested in popular music mostly, and just the way that people compose and the way that compositional practices has changed in the last decades or so. And most people researching that, so most musicologists interested in those changes, are usually looking at those from a social perspective. So people are going to be like, oh, you know, in the 60s, there were all those social revolution, you know, and then we see changes that sort of matches those in compositional practices, which makes sense. You know, I'm not against that, and it makes a lot of, it's very interesting. But I was interested in more practical things, you know, like things like, you know, if you're moving from recording on a vinyl to recording to a CD to like Spotify, I mean, obviously these things need to affect the way that people compose things. So I was interested in this sort of the impact of technological changes on the way that people compose pop music. So I'm browsing around, looking at things, having some research ideas, but not really focused yet. And I come across this article from Wired Magazine from 1997 by Michael Goldhaber about the attention economy. And so this is in the 1990s, right? But he's saying something like, you know, most people think about it, our era of this like new internet thing,
right,
that was happening as this information era. So we have information everywhere. And people are talking about this information economy. And his point was like, well, you know, economy is about scarce resources, and information is not scarce. It's the opposite of that. We keep creating and generating more and more and more information. What is getting scarce is attention. So his point was like, what we're really interested in is this attention economy, not this information economy. So, and I was thinking about, well, wow, if you think of something like Spotify, you know, artists make like no money on Spotify.
Right.
But they put their songs willingly in there. So they must be getting something out of it. And that something is attention, you know. So if you think of the Spotify model from...
it's like top-of-mind marketing.
Right, exactly. Right? So once you start thinking of attention as basically a currency governing its own supply and demand model...
Right.
Then all of a sudden, the Spotify model makes a lot of sense because you can get attention from those listeners. And if that's your main currency, if that's the thing you're interested in, and that's really, really exciting. And it offers a lot of opportunity. So that was sort of my starting point. It's like, huh. And then I was thinking, well, okay, how different is Spotify from listening to pop music in the 60s, for example.
So, like where you'd listen to it on a radio or a record.
Exactly. So if you're living in a small town in the 60s, there are maybe two rock radio stations. So if you don't like the song on this one, you go to the other one, and that's it. And then, or maybe 45s. You know, 45s right. were pretty cheap. You can buy a 45, but there's really only two songs. And if you want to, if you don't like it, you need to like get up, go to your record collection, pick another one, put it on the pickup. So it's a little bit annoying. And then vinyls came, and then you have like five tracks on a record. But then if you want to skip a song, you need to get up, take your needle, move it around.
You aren't old enough, but I am. And I was never still enough with a record player to not like scratch the record.
Yeah, I can see that.
Just a problem.
Right. So then, like, the whole evolution of recording medium keeps increasing the amount of songs that we're getting
right.
and how easy it is to skip to the next one.
Right.
So even your tape deck, you could fast forward, and that made it easier than a record because you didn't have to cue it at the right place, you know. And then you get the CD player, and all of a sudden you have, like, those 14 tracks, and you can skip to the one you want. And I think the big like tipping point is when you get to the iPod in the early 2000s, because all of a sudden you have 300 songs from different artists. So all of a sudden your ecosystem, your environment, you know, your marketplace is not only populated by way more, like a lot of songs all of a sudden, but from competitors basically, right? So
and your choices change also when you have that much abundance.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. So the idea is that if you have a more competitive environment,
okay,
and the amount of songs keep growing, but your attention keeps being steady. I can only listen to so many songs.
Right.
As the gap between the two becomes bigger and bigger, your attention proportionally is scarcer and thus more valuable.
Right.
So the idea that I had was like, well, if your attention is more valuable and this is an economic market, people should go out of their way to try to grab it.
Right.
So the more songs there are that you can access quickly, the more attention grabbing you need to be to fight for brain time, basically.
Okay, super cool. As you're saying this about music, I realize that the same happened with television. Because when I was a kid, by the way, my first job, because I have all older siblings, was, this is before the remote control, I was the remote control. So my sisters used to make me stand at the TV and change the channel while they sat on the couch, right? And then eventually, there became a channel changer, and you click through channels, but you only had three or four. And then cable came, and you had 100, and you started bouncing between shows in warp speed, which also meant that the attention you gave to one of those became split amongst 100.
Correct. I think you're absolutely right. You're spot on. So the whole model that I'm thinking of, I'm looking at it from a music perspective because that's what I'm interested in most, but you're absolutely right. It applies to all information generator. So we're talking about TV and movies and movie trailers and radio shows and music, but also things like potentially book covers and things like that. Because when you go to the bookstore, web pages, you know, people switch web pages in around like 4 seconds or
right.
something like that.
And skim, skip, bounce.
Yeah, and there's so many web pages out there. We're generating them at a like increasingly right. big rate. So for all those products, the attention economy model makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So I'm going to give you another example. There's
yeah.
this, and I know this only, like we're talking casually, not from a research for
right.
researcher. So, but there's this idea in movie literature or narrative literature about the cold open. So it's this idea that you can start a movie right in the middle of an action scene. So the example I like to think is, like, imagine you're going to the next James Bond movie. And, you know, maybe you have, like, dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum. And it's like, James Bond is, like, running. And right. then we don't know what's happening. And then, like, someone's chasing him in a car. And then he's running, right in the middle of the action, you know? And that would make sense from an attention economy, because if I'm watching this on Netflix, you know, if after, like, 5-10 minutes, I'm bored of this movie because nothing's happening,
right?
I have no incentive to keep watching it. There are, like, hundreds and thousands of other movies waiting for me to watch them.
Absolutely.
Why would I wait for James Bond to do something cool? I want...
Get to it.
Get to it. Exactly. So I don't have data for this, but, like, we should expect the same thing happening in movies, you know, because the... Netflix is the Spotify of movies.
Right.
It increases the amount of information available for you instantly. And you would imagine that people would go out of their way to become more competitive just to adjust themselves to the environment.
Okay, so business of any kind, like the music industry, the television industry, starts adjusting in order to compete for the changing landscape.
That's the idea. So what we don't know is, or at least what I don't know, maybe they do, because I'm sure they have their research.
And in a moment, I want to get to some of your initial results that you've had, right? I think the audience would love that.
Yeah. So what's not clear right now is whether this is evolution, okay? So, you know, like, this is the big Darwin model. When your environment changes, you need to adapt yourself, and survival of the fittest. The songs that adapt themselves the most survive. So maybe it is possible that no one does it consciously. And this is just something that, you know, when you're more attention grabbing and it's more competitive, you win.
Right.
And then that's just it, just a game changer smoothly without people actively doing it.
Survival of the fittest.
Exactly. Alternative hypothesis, maybe people really know what they're doing. So maybe you're in a recording booth and Taylor Swift is, like, doing this new song, and she's got this, like, really, really cool intro with, like, I don't know, just like a trumpet solo or something like that. And it sounds super good, but maybe the engineer or the producer is like, you know, Taylor, it sounds really good, but I think if you cut it, like, it's a little bit too long, you know? So it's possible there's, like, those conversations behind closed doors of people suggesting those changes. The reality is probably somewhere right in the middle. So I think their survival of the fittest is happening, and I think that some of those decisions are also conscious.
I like this a lot, but here's what really pisses me off. Okay, just to be candid with you, I would think that marketers would be leading the way in how to hack attention span and not Taylor Swift. I don't have anything wrong with, I don't, you know, I'm not, like, anti-Taylor Swift, but I'm not a Swiftie. And, but when I think about it, it's like, how the hell are the people that should be specialists in attention hacking, marketers, behind the curve, and somebody who's a 20-year-old pop sensation changing the way that, or adjusting to the changing consumer at faster rates, that just boggles my mind.
Mm. So I think that for a lot of those things, I think publicity is slightly different. So the difference between, I think, publicity and a song on Spotify, mm-hmm. Most people think of songs on Spotify or a movie on Netflix or something like that as cultural products. And they have this art value to them. Mm-hmm. I think that's the main way that people like to think of them.
They think of them as art.
I think so. Or art-like, you know,
art-like.
Or a cultural product.
Cultural moments in time.
Exactly. And most people don't want to think of those as commercial endeavor.
Okay.
Of course they are, but like, we like to think that, you know, when Bruce Springsteen is releasing a song, he does it because he loves music, not to make, like,
money. In the interest of disclosure, if they aren't making money off of Spotify, then it is more of a commercial than art.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right.
Right?
So I think that the key to understand what's happening right now is we need to think of those cultural products as having two roles. So we tend to think as publicity as publicity and cultural products as cultural products. But I think if we really want to understand how those technological changes have an impact on those cultural products, we need to start thinking of them as, yes, cultural products, of course, but also as being small advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
So every song out there is basically a small 3-minute advertisement for the artist's brand, whether they like it or not. And that makes sense from Spotify, right? You don't make any money, but people are maybe going to buy your record or maybe going to come to your concert. If you have a perfume out because you're Katy Perry or something like that, they might buy your perfume. Maybe you get invited on like Oprah or Ellen DeGeneres or something like that. You know, you get exposure. That makes sense.
In the mainstream.
Exactly. And I know for a lot of people, they're frisky about this idea of like thinking of artists as releasing small advertisement. And I'm sure a lot of artists are frisky about that. But just from a theoretical point of view, I think that if we start thinking about this, about songs as small advertisement for a brand, and we try to like get away from all this negative connotation with it, just like think
and
of
the brand is the artist.
Exactly.
Okay.
Then I think that we can have a brand new look on how music is changing and how it makes a lot of sense from this marketing perspective.
Okay, so do me a favor. How has music changed in like the last 30 years to adjust for a changing attention span?
Right, so one of the things I was interested in to study, so I looked at 30 years of music from 1986 to 2050, and I basically chose those years because, 2015 was the last year I had full data when I started the study. That's just easy.
Right.
But like, I was interested because from those 30 years, we went from having music mostly listened to on the radio and on records to the CD becoming omnipresent and the main support to iPod, to Spotify. So we had this really big change in technology.
It's probably the biggest technological evolution we will ever have with music that took place then.
Correct. Right? Yes, because just like the innovation in bandwidth and internet and quite like the size of hard drive. Just like
from analog to digital.
Exactly. So that's what I was looking at. And I did some preliminary research on the sort of things that I could test that would be sort of proxies for attention principles. So here are a couple of things I looked at. I looked at the number of words in title. So this is a good example of something that if you think of something as a cultural product, the number of words in title doesn't make much sense. You're thinking, well, it doesn't matter if this title is long or short. But if you start thinking of it from a marketing point of view, or a small advertisement, you want people to remember the name of your song.
Right.
So short titles should be preferred to bigger titles. The other thing we looked at is tempo, so just the speed of the song. We know that faster songs increase arousal. And we know that increased arousal favors memory, so memory encoding. So it would make sense that songs become slightly faster, you increase arousal a little bit, and faster songs are slightly more memorable.
Right.
So that's one thing we looked at. Other things we looked at was like the time before the voice enters. So we know that the voice is like this huge thing that's really, really, really attention grabbing. There's this funny story about Muzak. So the way that Muzak was started, they basically wanted to increase arousal in workers without drawing their attention. That was the big thing.
And Muzak, for those that don't know, and I haven't actually heard the term in a long time, so drawing off my memory, this is kind of like background music that was before XM radio or satellite radio that was pumped into offices and restaurants, and you could have elevator style music or jazz, and it just was background.
That's exactly right. So it was designed as functional music for the workspace.
Okay.
So the big idea was we can increase your workers' arousal without drawing attention by playing music. And the main thing about music, and the reason why everyone thinks it's so boring, is that they're always instrumental version. It's always like yesterday, but there's like a trombone playing the melody. But Muzak knew what they were doing. The reason there's no voice is because they did studies, and they realized that if someone is singing, you just listen to the song, because it's interesting.
Right.
If you don't want people to pay attention to it, you get rid of the voice.
Right. And so, you can't, in our office at Wirebuzz, we're going to be playing music, the modern version of Muzak off of like Apple Radio. But we're going to be playing Chill, which is one of these pre-created stations. And it's kind of jazzy in a modern version, but there's no words.
Exactly.
And people can continue to write.
Exactly.
Without having a voice competing.
Exactly. So conversely, if you're a pop composer or pop artist, you want people to pay attention to your song. So it would make sense that you get the voice in as quickly as possible. So really short introductions should be going down or reducing. And then the other thing we're interested in is how long does it take before the chorus comes in?
know the hook of the song, you know the main part, like your punchline. How long does it take before I have to hear that?
Because now we're assuming in the digital age that people are actually they're not coming onto a song off of a station at any random point. They're coming to the song at the beginning.
Exactly.
Right? Because we're skipping.
Very good point.
Okay.
Very good point. So when you're skipping on a service like Spotify, you're skipping and you're always starting the song from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Even when you're changing playlist or the playlist being like the equivalent of the radio station now. So those were the things we're looking at. And let's look at some numbers. So we're expecting words entitled to shrink. We go from 3.1 on average to 2.2.
Those are words.
Words entitled.
Okay.
How long the title is.
Okay, so we almost lost a word.
Yes, exactly.
Or we did lose a word.
We did lose a word in 30 years. So the next thing we're looking at, tempo. Tempo on average increased by 8%.
Okay.
Okay. So not crazy, not super noticeable, but a real increase. Now the time before the voice comes in. So we're thinking, how long does it take for the instrumental introduction,
or even for the attention span to be grabbed by a voice that's communicating with you?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And now this is where it all happens. So in the mid 80s, it takes roughly, the instrumental intro is usually roughly 23 seconds. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the study, in around the mid 2010s, 5 seconds.
Wow.
That's a 78% decrease.
Getting right down to it.
That's a huge difference. That's the really, really the exciting thing that we're seeing in this study. If anything, that's what we're seeing. No more instrumental intro. It's too long.
Yeah. If you're planning on holding people's attention.
Exactly.
If you're doing a live concert, it might be great.
Exactly. That's a very, very good point.
Right?
In a live setting, it's totally different because people are not going to go away.
Yeah.
So it's not that people don't like listening to those things. It's just that you need to adapt what you're doing for a different environment.
Right.
So the last thing we looked at was the time before the title comes in, or the time before the hook comes in, basically. And in the mid-80s, it takes roughly a minute before you hear the first hook. And at the end of the study in 2015, we're at 49 seconds, something like that. So an 18% decrease.
Okay. In how quickly we get to the hook.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
Almost the architecture of a song is changing.
Very good point. Yeah, exactly. So the main thing we're seeing is that you're getting rid of the intro, or you're shortening it to like just a couple of measures. And then you, instead of having like, let's say like verse, chorus, maybe you start with the chorus right away and then you go to the verse or something like that.
Just like the James Bond analogy.
Exactly. Just like the James Bond analogy. Okay. So you don't bury your lead, you know. You
right.
Just go right away. Say what you have to say right now, right here.
Well, maybe we did that in this conversation. Maybe we buried the lead to 10 minutes in when the real information is that back in like 1985, it took roughly 23 seconds to get to the first lyrics.
Correct.
And now 30 years later, it's taking 5 seconds. And are we looking at is this like the top, what top songs? Like, how do you select these songs?
Top 10 every year for 30 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is top 10 based on the hottest songs of the year, the most popular songs of the year.
Correct. So it's top 10 based on the Billboard charts, which is the big company that track those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So that's pretty exciting.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Now, where I get into this is, I'm particularly fascinated by how businesses use information like this in an attention economy to be able to get right to it, to hack the attention span of a consumer that is going to spend 4 seconds on your website, leave, and continue to research somewhere else.
Correct.
And the way I look at it is businesses, in order to hack the attention span, have to speed bump the experience by slowing people down, because people have to get educated before they make a buying decision.
Right.
So in this context, when I use video for businesses, I'm doing something very similar, but instead of doing a long draw, we're getting right to it.
Right. Correct. So I think what's interesting from a commercial point of view is to So think about your product, which, so I was mostly interested in music, but we can apply the same sort of things to video. So that's what you're most interested in. So yeah, getting to it quickly, but then if we're dealing with visual, so maybe the color scheme could be interesting. So we want to make sure that we get those distinctive color patterns.
Right.
So because you want the information to be easy to read. So processing fluency is like this big thing. If it's
right.
hard to process consciously or not, then it's not attention grabbing. It's,
right.
It's very hard. And I think that one of the important things too is that you can't grab attention with just anything. So I think that the people who manage to do this and be really successful at it is you want to grab attention with information that's relevant to the user.
Mm-hmm.
So the anti-example to this would be all those clickbait on the internet, you know?
Sure.
Deals are very attention grabbing. And I'm on like the New York Times webpage, and then I scroll down and it's like, you'll never believe what was in our bathroom or something like that. And I do see them all the time.
We all do.
Of course. But I've been burned so many times, you know? Cause
right.
So you learn not to click on them.
Right.
So I think that you want people to pay attention to things quickly, and you want the information to be rewarding, basically.
Right.
You want it to be relevant to the user so that they basically can learn that, oh, that was good information. That was a good prediction of myself. Mm. You know, I decided to pay attention to this, and I invested my money, my
right.
attention currency, on something that was worth it.
Yeah, that's a super point. And a lot of people don't take it into consideration. We have to make sure that not only is the information succinct and compelling, but hyper-relevant to the end user.
Correct.
And the higher the relevancy, the higher the level of engagement. Let's take a music example. I grew up in a beach town.
Mm-hmm.
And in a beach town, we don't listen to classic rock. Everything is reggae.
Okay.
So I actually only knew reggae as being... You know, going through high school, I remember somebody came up and offered me my first week in college. A friend said, hey, I've got an extra backstage pass to go see U2. And I said, great, who are they? Okay? Because I grew up in a beach town.
Right.
If you told me it was Bob Marley, I'd be like, great,
right.
let's go.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Or even any of the fringe reggae acts, I would know them too.
Correct.
And still to this day, if I'm listening to music and reggae comes on, it's hyper relevant to me.
Correct.
And I'll listen to it longer than something that isn't relevant.
Correct.
Right? It's all about attention span and relevancy.
Correct.
Yeah. Super interesting.
Yeah. So I think we could apply this analogy to a marketing strategy. So consider the difference between advertising. Okay, let's say you're a company creating meds for something, whatever.
Did you say meds?
Meds.
Medication.
Yeah, medication,
okay.
Drugs, whatever. And let's say you're advertising at the Super Bowl. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So really, really big crowd, but maybe people who need the drugs you're creating are very, very, very small. So if you want to grab people's attention, you'll need to go very broad, right?
Right.
Because you don't know who they are.
Right.
And they don't...
And they don't identify.
Exactly. They don't expect the information to be relevant to
yeah.
them at that point. However, if you're advertising in the middle of a documentary on that disease that people
right.
have, for some example, then perhaps you don't have to be as attention grabbing because
okay.
the information content, people will be expecting it to be more relevant to what they're interested in already. So I think tailoring to your environment is a very, very important
adjusting
thing.
To the ecosystem that you're in.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly.
All right, so I think it would be, I bet you if you took your study with attention span in music and you analyzed the same songs from what's playing on radio or Spotify, like the digital version compared to the live version, you'll find that the live version, they've already got a captive audience. And it doesn't matter how quick they get to the hook.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's what we would expect.
Right.
So something else that I've been thinking, and I don't have any data on this, but like I was thinking, you know, all those indie bands were really into releasing their music on records and their fan are into listening to music on records. We shouldn't see this effect to be as big because
their fans are mostly listening to it on a record player.
Oh, I see.
So that's what I mean by tailoring it to the environment. Yeah. If the main way of consuming your product is something that is information rich, that is very, very competitive, then you need to adjust yourself. So in a competitive environment, attention is...
It's a commodity.
Exactly. It's worth more money. It's worth more money, and you need to go out of your way to catch it. Mm-hmm. If the environment is not as competitive, then you don't need to be as aggressive in trying to grab it.
Okay. I like dating analogies. In marketing and sales, I think they're highly accurate. In a bar, guy walks up to girl, has to be more aggressive. It is, at least he thinks, it's a competitive environment. And if he goes to a yoga class and he's the only guy in there and everybody else are girls, it's not as attention grabbing. He has a different type of engagement dynamic because the environment is different and as such modifies his interactions.
Correct. So if you're in a dating environment or a place where you're trying to get a date, and there's a lot of people out there, for both parties, you might be tempted to judge more quickly.
Yeah.
Simply because the offer is bigger. So if
people do that though on Spotify, it's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Right.
Right.
They judge quicker, make a decision, move on.
Correct. So again, if the environment where you're in that dating situation mm-hmm. where there are less people, then maybe something that would have bothered you at the club won't bother you as much.
Right,
because the environment is less competitive.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
That's really interesting. Okay, where's your study going next?
So the next thing we're interested is to see if... So right now, where we're standing, we know that people change the way they compose music. So we know that people basically adapt themselves to what they think works. So we know that, if I'm taking a marketing analogy again, people will go see firms like yours to get really good videos, right? So the next thing we're trying to see is, does it work? Does the songs that do those things that are really attention-grabbing, do they survive more? Mm-hmm. Do they get skipped less? Here on campus at Ohio State, we have those experiment booths, which we're sitting in right now. And so the next step, we're having participants come here and listen to those songs. And we're basically creating a Spotify-like interface. And we're just asking them, listen to it the way you would listen at home. And if you don't like the song, just skip it. And if you like it, you can keep listening to it. So it doesn't affect the way you're doing it. So we're doing this in two ways. We're doing active listening and passive listening.
Can you define the two?
Yeah, of course. So active listening, we're asking people, come in the booth, do nothing else, don't look at your phone, listen to the music, and then if you don't like the song, skip it. If you like it, sing along, listen to it, do whatever you want. So that's interesting, and it gives us a nice scientific control, because we know nothing else is happening. Mm-hmm. However, it's not super ecologically valid, because people don't listen to music that way at home. Mm-hmm. So the next step, which we're about to start in like 2 weeks, is we're getting people in the lab, and we're going to ask them to... interact in social media while they do it. So we're trying to create an environment that is closer to the way
an organic environment.
Exactly. So what we're heading for right now is creating an Instagram page. Mm-hmm. So we're basically asking people, you're here for an hour. We've created this Instagram page for you. We've populated it with those cute animals or whatever. Go around, just spend your time on it, and we're going to play a playlist of music for you, and you're free to skip it if you don't like it.
So you create almost of a diversion.
Exactly.
Right?
Not almost. We're exactly creating it.
Okay.
Yes, exactly.
So you can have a more native experience in how they adjust to music.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if... You know, I want to follow along in your results. When do you expect to have some kind of data that would be, you know, able to be public?
So we have unpublished but preliminary data already for the active listening. So
okay.
That happened last spring, and the results are a little bit mixed. So right now, the number of words in the song and the title and the tempo seem to influence the way people are reacting to the music in the expected way. So songs with shorter titles get listened to more, and faster songs get listened to for a longer time period.
Okay, good.
So that would be the same way that the theory is predicting it.
Any information about lyrics that have a couple words versus denser lyrics?
That's a good point. We're not looking at that at the moment, but that's something that would be interesting.
Because I'll tell you right now, I like denser lyrics because if you give me like two words in a song, because I'm a creative person, I'm irritated with that artist.
I see.
That's just my two cents. It's like, hey, dude, I could have come up with that in 10 minutes and you've made a song out of it. But if you've got great lyrics, it's telling a rich story, then that takes work. That's art.
So we do have some data not collected by me, but from other people about... So they were not thinking about attention economy, but I think it's applicable. So they looked at how repetitive lyrics were becoming in the last years. And what they found was that songs are using more repetition within lyrics.
With like hooks inside of the lyrics, right?
Yeah. So the song themselves are becoming more repetitive and hooks themselves are also coming more often.
Yeah. Okay.
So that would sort of make sense a little bit. Like if you're trying to sell your product, you want to like repeat what you're doing. And we know that repetition increases processing fluency once again. So once you've heard the lyrics, maybe it's easier to process what's happening. Mm-hmm. So going back to your experiment, the two other things. So in the first study we did, just looking at the songs themselves and analyzing it, the really big thing was like those introductions that were shrinking. That was a very, very exciting thing. When we get participants to come into the lab, we don't see the same results. In fact, we see the other way around. So songs with longer introductions were listened to for a longer time period. So that was surprising. What we don't know right now is this could be because we're getting participants in a lab setting.
Right.
So it's possible. So our participants are second year students here and they're doing this for credit. So it's part of the things they have to do for their degree. So it's possible that when we're asking them to come here, since lyrics are so important to pop music, there's such a fundamental part of it. It's possible that our students are coming here and feel like if they skip before the voice came in, they're not doing the experiment.
Right.
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 So we need to test this again to make sure that whether this is actually happening, whether people are really waiting for the voice to come in, or whether this is just a byproduct of this setting that we're here, this sort of artificial setting.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Isn't this information valuable to a company like Spotify?
Yeah.
Right? Like, shouldn't a company like Spotify be giving a researcher like you access to a significantly larger database of research so they could better serve their end customer?
Absolutely. So if there are any...
It sounds like you set me up for this, right? But we did not talk about that.
I know. So if there are any Spotify people hiring, no. So Spotify is actually sharing a lot of their data to the public for anyone who's interested in doing apps and research. And so they have this API that you can interact with to get information. And they have a lot of information that they do through audio signal processing about the features of the songs. So they can evaluate tempo, like what key it's in, like how energetic a song and things like that. So they have a lot of info out there. What's not available for outside researchers like me is everything related to user. So all the information related to user, so how quickly they skip and things like that, this is confidential information that they own.
Oh, I see.
I don't have any secret insight of how it's happening in Spotify. I imagine that they have research labs and that they're doing the type of research that I'm doing and that they may be not publishing it because they're like their trade secret. But yeah, I think that industries, and from a music point of view, but also just other industries doing information generation and things like that, could benefit from like having this sort of approach to their product.
Yeah. It's funny, when we're talking about Spotify and their database, it reminds me of from 2003 to 2007, I was leading digital marketing projects for seven of the largest nationally syndicated talk shows in Hollywood. And each one of those shows would have 20 to 30 million unique visitors a week coming to the website. So just like Spotify with having a huge audience, I discovered that when I would go dig into the analytics, the answers were always in the analytics, and I could lose a whole day just nerding out on how the audience is engaging with our content.
Right.
And back in 2003, I started noticing that video, the engagement around video, was 10 times higher than the engagement around any other content that we were creating.
Right.
So I knew there was something freakishly magnificent about the power of video.
Correct.
Right? And I would think that just having the access to something like the Spotify data would be a goldmine for Spotify. I'm sure they must be doing their own research.
I mean, Spotify is free, right? If you don't get the premium. So they're getting something out of it.
Right.
Nothing is free. So it's very hard to believe that they're not using users' data to see how people are using it. You know, it's
Google does it, Facebook does it, everybody does
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So nothing is free. When you get an app for free, you're giving something in return. Right now you're giving your musical preferences,
right.
Which is might be fine. Maybe you're okay with releasing it. But yes, I'm assuming that companies like Google Music and Apple Music and Spotify and Pandora.
They have to.
They have to.
All right, so this is interesting. In the video space, the way we do virtually the same thing is in a business context, we covertly on the back end of that video are tracking how long each individual prospect is watching the video.
Right.
And that real-time data gets sent into the CRM like Salesforce.
Right.
So if somebody is watching, like, let's say for the sake of discussion, over 80% of a video.
Correct.
In real time, we program that video player and the CRM to send an email to the sales rep
mm-hmm.
that says, John from Los Angeles at this one company just watched over 80%. Here's John's phone number mm-hmm. and email. Mm-hmm. Reach out to him. Because we've discovered that the attention span from somebody watching a video in a business context, that is an indicator of a high level of buying interest.
Right.
Right?
Yes, that makes sense, of course. So I think that the something that could happen in the future as technology gets more interesting, and especially because people are really willing to share their data. So
right.
Millennials don't really want to pay for things, but they're really okay with sharing a lot of information about themselves,
right.
Which may or may not be a problem for privacy, but for a business model, that's all. Like, there's a lot of information
right.
that's really relevant.
Like, even if Snapchat doesn't turn into Instagram, it still has 170 million monthly, and the data off of that is a huge business.
Of course, it's a huge business because you know. When do people use it? You know
right.
who they send it to? You know where they're sending it to? There's a lot of information.
Yeah.
So thinking, again, I'm using the music example because that's what I know best, but so we could think of a future where all this information you're giving to Google and Spotify and Facebook, and they can create a really good profile of what type of music you like. And they already do that, right? So on Spotify, there's like your weekly selection and they make playlists for you.
Right.
Things like that. We could imagine that they could make arrangements for you. So think of like a future where an artist could create like 2, 3, 4 version of a song where they're basically the same, but they're slightly
right.
different.
Tempo's different.
Exactly.
Right?
Maybe one has a instrumental intro with a guitar because you've got this like... From your profile, we know that you're this guitar player.
You're more likely to listen to an unplugged, stripped-down acoustic thing.
Exactly. So we could potentially in the future imagine a place where music is actually tailored for you.
Right. Hyper-relevant.
Exactly. And that wouldn't be that hard to produce, you know.
Right.
Because we've got already all this information about what type of music you like. We, like, through this information, we can create models that are probably know you better than you know yourself.
Right.
So yeah, that could be and
it's a higher level of service too.
Exactly. So that sounds a bit weird for Spotify, but think of it again, if you think of those songs as advertisement,
yeah.
Now that's a dream come true, you know. What if you could tailor your advertisement exactly to the public who's watching it?
Wow.
So even with smart TVs, you know, so the new thing now is like we're going to give you either TV or satellite service, and we can give you a discount if you're willing to share information with you, like maybe if we can record your reaction to like how you change channel, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are willing to share that information. So once this information is out there, well, for people paying
like a lot of money for those advertisements. Well, it makes a lot of sense. What if you could decide that family really, we need to tailor it. So maybe they're more in a rural environment. So we can change the setting of the ad that's on TV. And maybe we can change the accent of the people who are talking and the speed at which they're talking and things like that. I think this is where we can head to, like having this sort of tailored content for each individual.
Hyper relevancy.
Exactly.
Okay, that is super cool. I'm going to keep my eye on you, if you don't mind. I'd like to keep the audience up to speed on what you're doing. I think your research and information is key to understanding an evolving attention span. And the better we get at understanding the changing attention span, the easier it is to convince and convert people in a business context.
Correct. I agree with that.
All right, cool. You cool with me keeping up to speed on you?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for taking time to do this with me.
Of course. It was my pleasure.
Super cool information. I think you can tell that Hubert is really on the cutting edge of how society is changing and how our attention spans are different today than they used to be, and how marketers need to adjust for a rapidly changing customer, right? It's really interesting. Katy Perry understands this better than most marketers do, and really marketers should be the ones leading, not following. And as time progresses, you're going to hear more information from Hubert and I as we keep our eye on the attention span and the attention economy, which is really how you and I use something that is scarce, which is attention, and provide something of value so we can move a buyer through a buyer's journey. If this podcast episode was valuable to you, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, rate and review, share this episode with somebody that you're rooting for, and feel free to please send me any questions that you have along the way. Now, I am out here in Columbus for a couple of more days. My dad is flying out, and we're doing a guys' weekend and going to an Ohio State football game in the Horseshoe with 105,000 other people. Something you should know about my dad. That dude is in desperate need of a guys' weekend. You know, my dad has been an everyday dad with kids in his home for over 50 years. And when my dad turned 65, my dad and my stepmom adopted two kids from Haiti that they found in an orphanage and brought them back to the U.S. This is a year or so before the earthquake, and that did a horrible job taking down Haiti and even demolishing the orphanage that my brother and sister lived in before they came home to Arizona. And my dad's got, they're teenagers living in my dad's home. He's now 75, and thank God he's coming with me, and we're going to go to a football game together and have a good old time and check Ohio State off of our bucket list for a good Saturday college football game. Can't wait till dad arrives. Anyway, this is wirebuzz.com/119, episode 119, and I look forward to bringing you more information along the way, in the hopes that it helps you become a video marketing master.